And I would like to invite Eyal Weitzman and Jürgen Renn to come on the stage. Mm. So we continue with an open discussion, which will be moderated by Eyal Weitzman. And in the first 15 minutes, they will bind somehow together the different conversations, and then we open up with you, with us all. And I just want to briefly introduce Eyal. So let me introduce Eyal Weitzman, who will moderate now the discussion. He is an architect, academic, and writer who mainly focuses on architecture as a form of political intervention and the discipline's role in modern urban warfare. He's professor at the Goldsmiths Institute for Visual and Spatial Cultures, and he's director of the Center for Research Architecture, also at Goldsmiths. Since 2011, he directs the project Forensic Architecture, which produces evidence on war crimes in different forums, including international courts, tribunals, the Human Rights Council in Geneva, and the General Assembly in New York City. And now I hand over to Eyal.
Thank you very much. I just experienced, I guess, like many others here, the weirdest conversation ever. Because when Natalie was asking a question, Dominic was answering about something completely different. And was when Rivka was speaking about how to fill in a research application in English as a French speaker, I heard Wolfgang's neo-enlightenment position on science and science and the art. So, I mean, that was absolutely fabulous. I guess we should continue that that kind of discussion. One thing that I think occurs to me pretty much throughout this these last days is that the Anthropocene curriculum, the Anthropocene as a body of knowledge, requires us to somehow heighten our sensibility and sensitivity to the earth. And that field of knowledge of the earth requires that we somehow recompose those relationships between humanities, what was previously called the Humanities Science Division, etc. And I think it would be great for everybody that hasn't seen the Autolith Group Medium Earth film to actually see what it means to increase our sensitivity to the earth, what it means for a subject to be continuous with the earth, with seismography, etc. I think it brings together in a fabulous way a lot of what we discussed. It seems to me also that in order to do that, in order to compose a kind of a body of knowledge, in order to transgress those humanities science limits, is that the kind of people, the kind of humans that need to be in order to compose, to learn about the earth, cannot be the same humans as we were before. That knowledge is not simply something that you take in. You take in and you transform. And I kind of refer to something I either heard or misheard from Andrew in that. We need a different human in order to understand the earth. But I also want to point out, and then I'll turn it into a conversation, or I'll open it up to you as a first question, to think the opposite. In what way, perhaps in a similar way that Natalie was speaking about muscles and plants that learn, the earth, or the curriculum of the Anthropocene, is the earth learning to live with us, or the earth learning us. How we can invert that question? How does the earth senses? How the earth sense humans, our activity, how it learns to adapt to human, or would it act in, I hope not, to remove us from it? So that kind of processes of learning that are absolutely non-human learning, but in a sense, cumulative processes of adaptation, of experimentation, of trial and error, that could be taken outside of even the field of science, because now it is the earth that senses us, the earth that learns us. When the earth would learn the human, it also needs to be a different earth. So if the human learns the earth, we need to change. I think that's somehow the opposite proposition. So somehow I'd like to ask, within the kind of the field of your respective contributions, the management of knowledge and how knowledge creates social form and differentiation, you would like to respond to that question of how would the earth learn us in a curricular kind of way? Who is better to start than Jürgen?
I'm not sure. I'm a bit skeptical about the question. Maybe therefore I'm the right one to ask, because first of all, I don't think it's a new thing that the earth learns about us. The earth has learned about us basically since the time we came into being, and certainly since the first anthropogenic effects emerged. You know, think of all the co-evolutionary processes that came with domestication. You know, we have changed the environment. The environment still bears so many of the traces, you know, of our impact. And that these are complex systems that have memory in a way. And the Anthropocene is partly exactly about this memory. So the earth is learning a lot about this, and is learning all the time about this. Whether that's a good thing for us, you know, taking really the decentering perspective that Andrew suggested, is of course another question. And then the other part of the question, there, I want to go back to a remark that I fortunately captured switching to Andrew Pickering, which was about the decentering on the one hand, and this issue about projecting human concepts like intelligence and this issue of otherness. You know, talking about learning, I've in my first reaction said, yes, we can talk about the earth learning, but we should also see and respect and reflect upon the otherness of the non-human parts of the Anthropocene. And we should be a little bit hesitant to capture that otherness in a too facile way in terms of our human concepts. That is not the Anthropocene, that is anthropomorphism. And the Anthropocene shouldn't be the age of anthropomorphisms. We should be a little bit careful here.
I have a little something, and I mean nothing. My first reaction to what you say, it reminds me of something which is obvious. When does preoccupation with environment, with the earth, with earth as a living something and so on, where does that start? It starts when people are massively in town. So it means basically us in the north, when we move from nature settings and became more and more urban, we start to invent these things, which was on the other side, which was nature with a capital N. Okay. So if I keep that in mind and now add what anthropologists have told us, they have told us that it is mainly us, again, from the north, that have, during two centuries or more, have explained to the others that we were rational in considering us and our conscious and so on, separated from nature. Trees have no feeling. Trees are just trees. We have feelings, not trees. But as anthropologists have shown, I mean, in many other cultures, it has always been more linked in the way you would like us to be now. But we have fought in the north to eradicate that as irrationality. And it's, in a way, it's even peculiar than you say, we should now do the contrary and not first ask the question why us, we started to separate worlds this way in such with the consequences we have, and now because the consequences are here, we are ready to teach again the others. We should feel differently, be again with the tree, and so on. You see my point?
I do. I'll reserve my right of response, actually. Wolfgang.
I don't think the earth is learning us. I think it's processing us. And the outcome could be a greatly degraded planet. It's just the outcome of the processes of this living planet that are happening. And I think from the viewpoint of an Earth system scientist that in the history of Earth, there were the geological changes like plate tectonics and there were some astronomical interruptions, but the big things that the planet had to process were innovations in biology. When suddenly photosynthesis was invented and the planet went from a reducing state to an oxidizing state, huge disruption of everything. And it really teetered on the brink of some big transitions there, and then some transitions actually happened. And then later when single-celled organisms became multi-celled organisms. Mm-hmm. And I think with the appearance of humans, I actually think that could very well be another big transition driven by biological innovation. And I think the innovation was not that humans came about, because humans lived for a long time on this planet and nothing happened. But there's something that happened later in human brains, in Homo sapiens brains, that we don't really know about, that I think is a major innovation. And that still has to be processed by the Earth. And previous major innovations in the history of life did cause huge chemical transitions in planetary states, as big as transitions caused by plate tectonics, etc. So in that sense, I think the Earth is processing us, and indeed the outcome is quite open. But I don't think it's learning us. We have to learn the Earth in order to kind of mend our ways, otherwise we might be in trouble.
I want to give Natalie, a quick example of Yael's The Earth Learning Us and the parable of the lobsters in Maine. And I don't know how many of you know this parable, but Maine, the coast of Maine, is kind of icon of wilderness, craggy rocks and windswept, and the entire economy of the state is based on lobsters. And for about 50 years, we've been predicting the crash of the lobster catch because they keep putting more and more pots down, and the lobsters can't handle it. It's an extractive industry. We use it for 50 years, their quotas have been exceeded and then exceeded and then exceeded and exceeded. And about 2.5 years ago, the Maine Lobster Research Institute put a video camera down in the lobster pots. And lo and behold, the lobsters are getting out. And it's only the ones that are kind of stochastically there. They'd figured out how to get out. So we've been actually feeding cultivating the lobsters and domesticating the entire coast of Maine, right? So there's lots of lobsters there. And of course that means the fisheries have collapsed because the lobsters eat the fish. And this craggy wilderness is in fact this domesticated wilderness that the lobsters have outsmarted us. So in the arms race of our adaptation, what we thought we were doing, we weren't. And who's in charge here? I'd give my vote to the lobsters, in fact, which I think is a lovely example of what you're talking about. Who's learning who? Who is in this dance, this mangle, this way in which we are in these irreducibly complex, unpredictable systems that something's going on.
So do you think the resilience might surprise us? Is that what you're saying?
I think we don't know. I think, that the projection is not something we can predict. There is a non-predictability that's built into the irreducible complexity.
Because things have gone extinct, too.
Sure.
Amita?
Well, going back to the question of anthropomorphizing, I think that's a necessary warning that, one mustn't anthropomorphize. That's what I hear you saying, Jürgen. But at the same time, I think there's ways and ways of anthropomorphizing. So the question is, which particular one do we pick? And there may be ways by which that essential strangeness can be recognized. and acknowledged, but in ways which are creative and are useful for working with, rather than simply being, you know, false and in some ways, you know, violent.
I have also a remark. I was just thinking that my small child is anthropomorphizing her stuffed animal, and she attributes all kinds of motives and ideas and thoughts and feelings to this stuffed animal, which it's not true, but she takes very good care of this stuffed animal. So, okay, I don't want to be too instrumental here, but to anthropomorphize might be functional to some extent and might actually help to create sympathy and actually to care.
I think also just a minor comment before passing on to the source of that comment and debate is to say that I think there's two processes here. We need to earth ourselves in as much as we anthropomorphize the earth. And that is a process that I alluded to. To study the Anthropocene, we cannot be the same humans, and to study us, the earth cannot be the same earth. It's a different earth. It's the Anthropocene. And this is what I was alluding to, I think. But a joint curriculum would have to include both forms of learning. And it's not a metaphorical comment, learning. It's a system of adaptation, of accumulative and reorganizing knowledge over time. And that's what I was alluding to. Sorry, I think Andrew has his...
That's a nice point. I mean, I've come much too late to this project. I mean, it's nearly over. But it seems to me that, you know, a central topic for thinking about the Anthropocene is actually to think about ourselves. We seem to be trying to avoid it all the time. We talk about knowledge, and you pointed it in the other direction. How does the earth adapt to us? But what kind of people are we? You know, are we the right kind of people to get grips with the Anthropocene? It's a question about what kind of people are we like inside? What kind of selves are we? And I have the awful feeling that the entire educational process of the West sets us all up to be dualists. It makes us self-contained, controlled centers of the will and action, all ready to dominate things. We can argue our way out of it in words, but it might be necessary in the end that we do something rather deep to adapt to the world. Other traditions do not produce the same kind of dualist dominating selves as the West, right? There are many ancient traditions with many ancient technologies of the self that produce selves that are non-dualist, that experience themselves as being in the world, a part of it, not controlling it. So you might say part of the Anthropocene curriculum should be what Aldous Huxley called the non-verbal humanities, not centered on words, not centered on language. I mean, I offer you meditation as an example of a technology that can at least produce a kind of non-dualist inner state. Maybe that should be... I say this to my students, they look at me like I'm crazy. But...
Yes, Jürgen.
Let me be a bit provocative. Much of what I have heard now and also in the table talks, and in particular what my friend Dominique just said, sounds a bit like romanticizing the Anthropocene. Sounds like returning to really, I think, Wolfgang, you mentioned it in your contribution, returning to the Enlightenment and anti-Enlightenment discourses. And it sounds like if we could return, or if we could undo some of the things as Northerners, you said Northerners, normally people say Westerners, that's interesting, have done to this world. That, even if we could do so, and I don't believe we can do so, I mean, just think of the question of nuclear waste. We can deny nuclear energy, we can even imagine to abolish it completely, hard enough as that will be, that will not get rid of the nuclear waste. So the traces that we have left will remain. All of these projects are highly path-dependent, and we cannot undo the path we have taken. So I think the new challenge of the Anthropocene is not just a return to some romantic state, but it's, you know, a transition from the state that we have now to, and there I agree very much, Ayal, with your remark about a more earthbound knowledge, making ourselves more ready to enter a reciprocal relation with the earth. So that I found a very satisfying answer to my challenge of the anthropomorphism. But I think now we have to, you know, lay out a trajectory on how to go from where we are to a state where this reciprocity will be achieved. That is the challenge, not unthink it, not undo it, because we can't.
No, of course. I think we should open up. There must be a roaming mic somewhere. If you could just stand and just say who you are before you answer.
Hi, my name is Natasha Janwala. I'm a curator and a writer. I was somewhat concerned by the evocation of the expedition, which arrived at the very end of the conversation between the two men, Dominique and Wolfgang. And it seemed that this evocation of the expedition is also something that, of course, as you know, has a colonizing legacy, but also its character has primarily changed, I would say, because since the late 19th century, the expedition is also the exploration for resource very, very directly, right? So whether that is resource extraction, etc., from aerial explorations to war explorations, I'm just wondering why exactly do we trust that particular mode of seeking knowledge and the limits of knowledge?
Yeah, I use that picture. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think that the building of imperial empires was the first indication that the resources, that the way that the social reproduction is organized depends on resources that are not local anymore, but that need to be gotten from somewhere else. And so these are the first indications of things hitting limits that are overcome by spatial expansion, and part of that program was the exploration. And now the limits are the whole planet, and now, you know, the different expeditions meet and fight about who gets what. And I mean, all that is an expression of an unhealthy relationship to the material cycles of the planet, or a lack of understanding. And so in that sense, I completely agree with you.
I must confess I have difficulties hearing because it's not very simple. I'm not sure to have exactly understood, because in that position we do not understand very well. But since you refer to that part of the conversation we had, I would say, yes, those large expeditions, the first globalization process that started 5 centuries ago, the first wave, the second wave, we had several waves like that. No doubt that with that move, a first thing which has to be said, we spread our rationality and try to destroy the rationality of the others. And in doing that, we privilege us being different from nature and allowed to master it. That's the first point. The second thing, yes, it was a battle between the main empires to control the world. That's what it was about, to control resources, to control people, to control territory. But that being, and of course it was, because we transport with ourselves our own microbes, we destroy, we kill them with our guns, but we also destroyed them heavily by our microbes. That was Latin American history. Okay, that being said, what struck me is how much up to the early 20th century at least, how much the knowledge we believe in the North or in the West, I don't know, you say as you wish, the idea that we develop knowledge alone, in a way, is a complete mistake. I mean, most of the knowledge that was elaborated since the 15th century, end of the 15th century, has profoundly been built by the exchange we had with all the people that were encountered everywhere in the world, over the planet. And it's not only natural history, it's agriculture, it's sanitary business, it's nearly everything, perhaps apart some bits of physics. But apart from that, it was heavily built in various places, in Calcutta, in Lima, and so on. It is there that the new knowledge we consider our knowledge were built in the encounter with merchants, with artisans, with the people, the learned people on the spot, and so on. That has to be said. I mean, it's a complex, two-faced history.
And as you have discussed a lot about agreement and controversies, I overheard Dominique and Wolfgang. I want to say I totally agree with you, that both parts of the story are true. And this is very important for our history because it does not make science into this Western rationality. Much of the science that we have is really global knowledge because it has the global knowledge that you so nicely summarized. So just agreement on this point.
Maybe it's just a brief remark about this global nature of knowledge that, in a way, of course, it's true both historically and now in our global world. At the same time, I see that there is a big exclusion mechanism related to language. So those that speak English and can work in English are much more prominent in knowledge development and knowledge dissemination and knowledge use than those that are not. So in that sense, I think the picture is, of course, not as global as we would maybe want. And I see this in funding practices a lot. It's very difficult for non-English, non-native speakers to get funding, basically, for research. It's more difficult.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble being able to clearly hear both of you with this sort of echo effect. But if I heard you correctly, it seemed to me, Dominique, you're saying that the knowledge that was produced from the colonial encounter is a hybrid one, right? Certainly. But I think what one needs to then do further is go into the power dynamics of exactly how those forms came to be assimilated into certain sorts of systematized forms of knowledge which then gain dominance over other forms. I look at, for instance, botanical knowledge in, say, South India, in the Malabar coast, and the way in which it gets assimilated into, say, Western forms of taxonomy, and then certain medicinal plants which had been used for thousands of years get taken into a Western pharmacopoeia. Certain essential elements taken out, and then proprietary rights exercised over them in ways which are completely divorced from the systems of knowledge in which those plants happen to be integrated within, say, Ayurveda or Yunani medicine and so on. So while recognizing belatedly the fact that this knowledge is a hybrid is, I think, an important acknowledgement, it's not enough because something profoundly transformative has happened to that knowledge, something that's hard to, in a way, compensate for or, you know, sort of offer redemption for today. So I think when one tries to look at the ways in which knowledge gets appropriated into certain forms of economy which are dominant, which also generate profits in a very material sense, then there's a continued history of colonization that gets written over and over again. I think we have to deal with that when we talk about the encounter as a fruitful one, because it was fruitful, but not always for everybody.
I would totally agree with you there, and I think the history cannot be undone, but we have to take it as a challenge for the future. So from my perspective, and you both, I have heard, have discussed this, what can one do to make knowledge production more inclusive? and more accessible. And I think, and this is also going in the direction of funding agency and everybody who lives in the academic world, a minimal, certainly not a sufficient condition, is open access to knowledge. I think it's a minimal condition for cooperative and accessible knowledge production, also in order to overcome those disciplinary boundaries, also in order to overcome the digital divide that is now separating the world. It's only one element, and I don't want to ideologize it, but it's a very, very important component. And we shouldn't forget those political dimensions when we talk about knowledge.
I agree completely. I'm not sure that you're saying anything that anybody here would disagree with. You're speaking to the converted. But the question really is whether this forum is the forum where that process of creating open access is going to happen. I'm here speaking in English, a language that most people in my country don't speak. I'm using a technical vocabulary that is unfamiliar to most of them. They have a completely different understanding that I cannot articulate on their behalf, and yet they're not in forums like these. And that's just one small fraction of the larger world with whom we hope to share knowledge. I mean, it's only when we begin by acknowledging the deep difficulties that stand in that path that I think we can start thinking seriously about how to overcome those. Because despite our good intentions, I think those obstacles are real in the sense of serious inequalities in terms of access to concepts, language, frameworks for understanding things.
Could abuse and say, it will be very short. One point, I fully agree, and I have no doubt about that. And that's why I told you when we met the first time, I also agreed profoundly with part of the discussion in which you took part this afternoon. And it was a discussion in the room this afternoon about who is the we. And at the same time, I understand why we should speak in a we form. But at the same time, we have to realize there are no we. The world is more complicated than that. So we have to, it's, of course, you have a sedimentation of history, but even today, the world is not a we. We are not going, I mean, I'm perhaps too realist in social terms, but I do not believe the world is, as a we, is going to realize what Anthropocene means. It's a little more complicated than that. So that's what I wanted to say. I stopped now. I will shut up for a while.
One last point, and I'll make it very brief because I don't want to monopolize. I think the we is a conceit. I think we use the we because it makes us feel we're speaking for a larger collectivity. I think the views expressed here are probably going to be irrelevant given the way the rest of the world is moving and the way in which these large, very systemic processes at work. I mean, we're just a bunch of eccentrics at the end of the day.
Agreed.
Yeah, but the only problem is that whether the planet is warming when we submit CO2 is not a matter of whether the majority of the people on the Earth agree. We do have that aspect as well. I know I come off as a bloody positivist here, and I'm deeply not. I love, you know, if I had a choice how to make my statement about the world, it would be an abstract poetry of some sort because it's deeply more meaningful than any scientific article I ever write. But that does not prevent us from the fact that, you know, if we take in all the knowledges of the world and the world interpretations and add them together, it will not come up with the finding that CO2, only the crazy experts kind of maybe can provide that aspect. So I think, you know, if you say it's more complicated, I think it's also more complicated in that sense. And knowledge is one part, but what you do with it. I think this question that you ask, I like that very much, even if your students seem to be skeptical, this question about, you know, who are we and who do we want to be? And I'm also skeptical about whether the we, I mean, we like to emphasize the differences, but, you know, when I go to China or some other place, I do feel that I'm not in a completely foreign planet. I do relate to people in some ways, and most cultures on this planet think that there's a certain value in life, that not everything should be destroyed. So I also think that there are some elements where we could You know, it's not the big we, of course, but to just say, you know, never say we because, you know, everybody's different. I do think there are some things that, you know, could be the outlines of a global agreement on that some things, you know, we might want to just choose, but by free commitment, not because there's a law to it, but because if there's an agreement that something should be valued, and I mean, we're discussing it with human rights, is it, you know, can there be a culture that says human rights are just not part of our culture and things like that?
I very much agree, and issues like this is all very complex, and we are just eccentrics, do sound a bit to me like excuses for not taking up the responsibilities that come with knowledge. That I think things are very complex, but still the experience is that one can change things, and that one can change things through knowledge, and that it is therefore important how we produce knowledge, how participatory knowledge is. And I think, I really believe not only that we are all eccentrics, I think none of us would be in this field of knowledge if we wouldn't believe that it had some effect.
No, but if we would not understand that it has also dangers, that it has violence that is fossilized into it, and that universal knowledge is, or that knowledge is a universal project in as much as a V&A in London is a universal product. It's not. It's a collection that is undertaken through a particular perspective. And I think that we need to absolutely go into the micro ways in which politics operate in relation to knowledge and what kind of conflicts, power balances, and violence is structured in it. So it's not simply about increasing knowledge and participating, I think.
I would, may I just dispute this? Because you insisted that many of my colleagues are doing that, going in the micro, micro, micro. I say one of the lessons that we can take home from the Anthropocene is go into the macro, macro, macro. Because that's what we are learning from the geologists. You know, these things span enormous times. And it's not just human time, it's biological time, it's earth time. And I think what we are talking about, knowledge, is part of this process.
Yeah.
And only if we understand that large dimensions, we will be able to do something with our knowledge.
But what kind of erasure occurs with the abstraction of going up in scale? Why can we not think simultaneously in small scale and in large scale? Why is that an alternative to each other? Why do you have to completely forget about the small scale in order to scale up? Why can we not look at connections that are existing in that we can identify in specific knowledge production, in specific hierarchies, and in specific places as part of a process which is much larger?
Sure.
It's not
okay.
I don't think it's a contradiction. I think that the macro images get constructed by generalizations and by averaging away many of the details. And the big unknown is what are the principles of this construction? But those macro, this is the think globally aspect. But of course, the meaning of any global macro construction is always only there in a very specific micro context. So this whole think globally, act locally, think locally, act globally, those two things, that relationship really means that you have to do generalized macro concepts, but then what they mean always depends on a very concrete local situation. If you have only one or the other, in both cases, you're in trouble, I think. So in that sense, it's a moving in scales and not in... Meaning is always local,
yeah.
But the earth times are not local.
Yeah. I think perhaps we open up to this, to Andrew and Natalie a little bit.
To me? I don't know if I can follow on from that, but I was saying to myself... there's a kind of knowledge which is therapeutic knowledge, knowledge that puts knowledge in its place. I think maybe, for example, Natalie's works, which are much on my mind at the moment, have this kind of therapeutic value that they show us in particular situations that our knowledge doesn't command the situation. We haven't got everything under control. I think that kind of recognition plays into different ways of acting in the world at any scale you like to think of, from the micro to the macro. To go back to Jürgen's opening provocation, I don't think this means going back, you know, thousands of years in history. I think we are locked in kind of arms races of our own production with nature, which go with the attempt to dominate and continual failure. I'm not sure there's any way out of that, but I mean, if you recognize that we don't have this kind of commanding panoptic knowledge which gives us the levers of power, as I said before, we could act in different ways, adaptive ways, at all sorts of different scales. You know, in the engineering of water, for example. So the challenge would be to, you know, bring Taoism up to date for the 21st century techno-scientific world. Random improvisation.
But what do you think would bring about that change of heart, that humility, that realization of the limits of a certain kind of, you know, technological treadmill that we seem to be on?
I mean, I think, you know, if, in an educational institution, you can make people look at examples of, you know, case studies. It's very old-fashioned, you know, of processes where we intervene, we think we're in charge, something else happens. The story of the Mississippi River and the Army Corps of Engineers is a beautiful one, but there are many, many other ones. I think you could show people complex systems. I was going to mention a few tomorrow. Just show them worlds that, on the one hand, you can understand them atomically in terms of the rules that they operate, but they still have emergent properties that you can't master. You just have to learn to get along with them. And like I said before, you know, a bit of work on the inside self would probably fit in with that, which wouldn't be a verbal thing. It would have to be, you know, meditation or something along those lines.
I think to add on here, I'm sort of holding back because I thought we'd get some more things. But this idea that what kind of knowledge or person the Anthropocene demands, you know, is the maker's knowledge, is God's knowledge. It's actually that we are the makers, that we are, you know, this, you know, it's an extraordinary ask, you know, of a type of knowledge that is really interesting, because knowledge can scale up macro and down micro, but agency doesn't, right? So we have where we can act, and the kind of radical failure of the Enlightenment project that presumes that, you know, knowledge will lead to action, right, when it doesn't, right? Yeah. What kind of knowledge, action actually leads to knowledge, is that kind of reversal where the designing, making, screwing, experimenting is in fact the only way to interrogate these indomitable, irreducibly complex systems, right? A small-scale experiment that might scale, might not, might speak back in different ways. And I think that makes what's interesting to me is just how, you know, the conventional form of knowledge, the paper, the scientific paper, as it's become more and more accessible, that you can now sit in your tree office and read as many papers as you like, it's become less and less relevant, right? And that what actually taking the kind of knowledge that is a small intervention that you can juxtapose with radically different representations, the physical material, the talking back of the world, with the formal knowledge production mechanisms, becomes this kind of mangle that I think is the mess of the maker's knowledge, right? So to call ourselves this, to recognize the Anthropocene is to ask, can we respond? What is our response ability? What is the ability to respond? And, you know, one, of course, response is not to respond, which I would call the way we frame many of our questions, global biodiversity loss, global energy systems, global climate change, specifically creates this. You can do, by definition, you can do nothing about global climate change. By definition, you can do nothing about global energy systems. And so the idea of producing the kind of knowledge that you have agency on and accountability to is a much more modest, messy, post-enlightenment kind of relationship to knowledge production that cares less about open access as the kind of paradigm of knowledge and cares more about material practices that are co-produced in local contexts.
I think in his intervention, Dominique made it clear that there is global agency and part of the Anthropocene is due to the effects of the global agencies. You were referring to the chemical industry and to the molecules it produced. So here we have, I think, quite an impressive instance of not just, you know, local action, but global action with global effects. And we have to recognize that is an intervention also based on knowledge, maybe not the kind of knowledge that will help us in the to survive the Anthropocene, but it is based on knowledge. And behind of this is a knowledge economy, as I tried to phrase it in my introduction. And so we have to cope with that reality. And it's not just about academic funding, and it's not just about the world outside of academia. It's there are powerful knowledge agents. We have to recognize that. And somehow, if we don't address those issues, and we have no clear answer to them, but I would argue that we do need knowledge, not just on the level of our own local agencies. We need knowledge about those actors, about how these knowledge economies that are so powerful and so influential, how they actually work, how they continue to appropriate knowledge, and how they continue to appropriate the world. We cannot just, you know, remain ignorant about it. We have, that is a level and a dimension of knowledge also that is precisely, I would say, the kind of knowledge that has been neglected in the Enlightenment, in the modernity enterprise, because it's not only highly complex, it's highly local and highly global at the same time. And we are just not used to deal with that kind of knowledge, but we have to open ourselves up to it.
Can I say something? I was wondering if this still makes sense to all of you, because I think the discussion gets really abstract, which is very interesting in a way, but I was just wondering if, and I think it's time indeed for a question from the audience.
I apologize for the interruption, but going on information asymmetry, or specifically, specifically with the rise of things like the internet and the gradual decrease of world poverty, information asymmetry seems to be going towards extinction or elimination. That is, if information is a flow from high places to low places, the interactions are going to change. The point was put forward earlier that much of our new knowledge is developed from different viewpoints coming together, but I'm curious as to your thoughts of what, how information will develop in the future if information becomes easily accessible to all. Right now it's expensive to learn, it takes time and investments, but a hypothetical situation that you could easily learn any subject or field, that essentially means everyone knows everything. There's no information asymmetry. How do you develop from there? That's where we're headed.
I think one big difference is, it's important to make the difference between information and knowledge. And I think learning will never be fast and easy, because it means understanding and internalizing and connecting and so on. So if anything, it might make it actually more difficult to understand and to have some sort of coherent idea of what something is about. So I think you should not confuse information with knowledge. It's true, though, that this availability of information is changing lots of things. And one of them is, of course, knowledge production, because if it's easier to get the information, there's a certain monopoly that researchers used to have that now is being, well, is kind of at least diminishing. On the other hand, it's very particular information that you can find online and other information you will not find online. So you might have an effect that you get a certain distortion, that you will have lots of salient information about particular types of topics and lots of other information that you actually will not see and will not process. So
I would say you don't see just tendencies. All these tendencies are human-made. And let me illustrate this point. So this is a useful distinction between knowledge and information, but much about what the internet is about is also connection between information. And that goes a step towards constructing knowledge, because knowledge is about connectivity. But who owns these connections? Who makes these connections, and who owns these connections? A good deal of those connections is now owned by Google. That's part of their business model. You know, and I don't say any search machine, I say Google, you know, because it's specific, it's concrete. And the future of the information and ultimately knowledge accessibility will also be determined by the question of who owns, who structures, who shapes the knowledge infrastructure. I personally believe that for answering some to some of the challenges of the Anthropocene, that's a very important dimension. We need to own this infrastructure. You know, as much as public. One of the issues was public knowledge, the public quality of knowledge. And so we have to make sure that this goes deep into the structures of this infrastructure, that we can appropriate, mobilize, use the connectivity that we are creating as a world population in this medium. But we don't own it yet, and so we have to fight for it. That's what I think about this.
Yeah, just maybe one reaction also in the overabundance of information, but also of knowledge. What I see in the policy world is that they're not looking at what is being said, but who is saying it. So as a proxy for the quality and of the information and for what to notice and what not, or to give attention to or not, they look at who is saying it. Is it, you know, Yale, Princeton, MIT, or is it some blogger from a crazy, you know, from an island in the sea or so? And so I think there's different, and that, of course, reflects an empowered structure, because who is going to be the one that's taken as an authority? And in one hand, you could argue it's now more open with the internet. On the other hand, it might actually also close much more, because people have more need for a structure and an ordering principle, because they're so confused. Everyone says everything, so what to believe? And then they look at who's saying it, not what is being said.
Just a quick point. Well, I think we sometimes tend to think of the spread of certain kinds of technologies, we tend to think of them in very instrumental ways. I myself learned the problems with this when I was working on the outskirts of a protected area in the Himalayas, where the government distributed television sets because it wanted people to be motivated to conserve wildlife in the area. And they thought people would watch Discovery Channel. Instead, they ended up watching serials about mother-in-laws and daughters-in-law and the fights between them, Bollywood songs. They watched everything except programs that motivated them to conserve wildlife. So I think we need to be aware that the existence of smartphones or computers out there doesn't necessarily mean people are sort of reading scientific articles.
I think we're coming towards the end of the panel. So I just wonder if people would like to have a closing. You don't have to, but I don't see any hands.
Oh,
do
okay.
You see? Hear that. Yeah, excellent. Please.
Hi. In all this complexity, as an activist, as an artist, there's one thing that always works very simply on the ground with people, and that is the concept of empathy. And if you look at the history of the word, maybe to make sure that we know what we're all talking about, it's related to concept of pathos or pain, or the pain of others, feeling the pain of others, or not in an anthropomorphic sense, but just in a sense of being able to relate or connect things with each other. Yeah. Perhaps you could say some things about that. I think that it might be something that is underlying a lot of the thoughts that we are having. And we are having many thoughts, but I'm not sure that they're always coming from the same place. Feelings are a very simple thing. Thoughts can be very complex. And sometimes I think that just our ability to feel, which is inspiring, our need to respond, might be a good place to start to know that we're all on the same page.
It's a good final word.
you like to respond? Does that mean?
I don't know. I mean, I'm more inclined to think about exteriority, that, the world is full of a multiplicity of entities that are interacting with one another. I'm not sure whether empathy or sympathy is the appropriate way to feel about it. I mean, the tremendous floods in England at the beginning of this year, sea walls were being washed away, people's houses were flooded, farmland was underwater. I think that was a very instructive experience for everybody. People were crying on the television, you could feel empathy for them. Were we supposed to feel empathy for the rain and the wind? It doesn't seem like it's necessarily the right way to go.
So just a short remark on empathy. I think empathy is a capacity of the heart, of the emotions, of the soul, but it's also a learning capacity. It's the capacity of changing perspectives, of see the world through the eyes of another, and maybe also a non-human human agency. So this defines different conditions for learning. So multi-perspectivalism, the capacity of embracing many perspectives, sometimes at the same time, as this evening was a way of learning to perceive different perspectives at the same time, I think is a very, very important condition for learning in the Anthropocene. And I think this campus, by the way, was a great opportunity for multi-perspectivalism. But that is in traditional teaching curricula rarely emphasized, I have to say. You know, even perspectives when they're just juxtaposed, like, you know, when you learn physics and then you learn biology, this is not what I mean. Perspectives need to be related to each other. That creates the capacity of empathy. And then, of course, you know, the two of you have been talking about global knowledge, global university academic structures. You know, they are surprisingly the same all over the world. And yet the perspectives of people in this world are very, very different. So I think our educational systems should reflect that diversity in a much greater way than they actually do. And they should, in addition, do it in a way so that we can learn about them all over the world. So I think this multi-perspectivalism as a condition for empathy is a great challenge to the future of curricula, of academic and any kind of learning institutions.
Well, our wonderful colleague Johan Rockström in Stockholm, he puts it in three ways, and that's like the largest framework that you maybe can put around these conundrums we find ourselves in. The first is planetary boundaries. You know, the change should not go beyond a certain magnitude simply because we can't be certain about what lies beyond. One can be optimistic about it, but, you know, there's big risk associated. So change should be limited to a certain envelope, planetary boundaries. The second is human opportunities. We live in an incredibly rich world that gives us a lot, and there are huge opportunities that can be used, you know, if you don't go about it in a brute force way. And the third is reconnecting with the biosphere. That's the empathy thing, and that is really that the value of life and the value of a beautiful place really has a very deep meaning. And all of these are equal, planetary boundaries, human opportunities worldwide, which are important, and reconnecting with the biosphere and with each other. And I think the challenge of how to like work with all of these three principles and then make them a guidance framework in the largest sense is really this civilizatory challenge, you know, to find ways and new programs and new paths of continuing our identity into the next phase as nations, as cultures, as traditions, as religions, keeping in mind these principles. I think that's a challenge to the civilizations on this planet, and we'll see whether we can actually meet that challenge. But I think it's a way that works well.
Natalie.
One of the absences in knowledge that that I think is worth addressing before the night closes, and is the translation of this idea of empathy that you brought up. That in my experience, the kind of close study, this biophilia, the kind of reconnection with natural systems or redesigning our relationship to natural systems. In all of my studies, it was only last year I came across this one simple idea that actually most of the world's biomass is in that subset of symbiotic relationships we call mutualism, where both parties benefit, or all the parties involved benefit. And I'd heard a lot about selective pressure and niches and competition for resources and predator-prey relationships. And in all of our evolutionary theory, we don't hear very much about the mutualists, which is, of course, all the corals, all the forests, all the terrestrial plants, all the pollinators, all the, you know, that mutualism is this natural template that I think is profoundly underemphasized, and that we can learn a lot from designing with and in mutualistic systems. And that capacity to seize that understanding that literally I was never taught, you know, and I've tested everybody that I, you know, all my students, do they know this simple fact that most of the world's biomass is mutualists? With probably a paragraph in your high school biology book about, and it's a fundamentally important political and moral and design lesson that I think we can take with us somewhere.
I can just respond to that and say I completely agree with you, but when I think of why mutualism isn't emphasized and yet, say, competition is, then I think empathy is not enough, because there's systemic reasons why we don't empathize with other human beings, with other parts of the living world. And to put it crudely, I think a lot of it is to do with capitalism, the ways in which people and things, living beings, become commodities. Because the minute we can dehumanize and livingize things and treat them as tradable, exchangeable, as, you know, things which are measurable in terms of money, I think that capacity for empathy, for appreciating mutualism, just disappears. So if we want to cultivate empathy, then I think we have to systematically attack the ways in which there are structures in place that keep us from recognizing humanity when we see it in others, from recognizing the right to exist when it exists in non-human beings. And I think that means tackling capitalism in all its forms of consumption, consumerism, and the multiplication of completely useless things and tendencies in terms of violence and competition.
I absolutely love the comment of about empathy, because I think it has within it a certain trajectory of proximity to things, which is both affective and epistemological. The kind of the impossibility to think from the point of view of another, of radical alterity, the alterity to object, to the earth, to you know, non-human forms, if you like, is not an alibi not to continuously attempt to do it. And I think that is the kind of what is held between the impossibility of achieving it, the impossibility of achieving identification, and the continuous desire to aestheticize ourselves to the world, i.e. to become sensitive to the world, to feel it, is a kind of a necessary condition of being in the Anthropocene, and that which is both a knowledge production and an ethical stand in relation to the earth. Would you like to?
No, I think that would make a perfect conclusion.
Okay, then.
only if you include Amita's point that this is also a political challenge. I don't want it to sound like it's a personal stance that you're taking in the Anthropocene. You know, I really, you know, agree totally with your remark. Empathy is a value, but we have to create the conditions for realizing it. And some of those obstacles are structural obstacles.
Yeah, this impossibility is, of course, political, and it's economical, and it is to do with a radical alterity. It's to do with all those things, but there is a kind of a trajectory that comes to transgress those limitations with acknowledging the impossibility of that transgression being effective. That's my point.
I think maybe it's time for empathy with our audience. So I think there's a lot that could be said, but I think that should happen in other ways and forms.
Okay. Thank you for listening.